Okay, great. Well, one of the things we've all come to learn in the last few years is that the threat to the nation has taken on new forms and things we didn't expect. The threat is greater than we might have hoped a decade ago, right? And some of the things we now face are as dangerous as anything we faced during the Cold War, or perhaps almost as dangerous. We don't want to overstate it. But there's real risk to the U.S. So NORTHCOM plays a central role. And there's some issues involved, I think issues maybe we'll hear a little bit about today. What is the role of the military in homeland defense, in homeland security? There are legal issues. There's coordination issues. And getting to work with all the, not only the federal agencies that are involved in this, but with the state and local agencies would be an immense challenge for anyone. And if you lay on top of that the question of NORAD, 10 years ago, missile defense was sort of a theoretical problem. Some of the air defense threats we see from opponents who are regaining their stamina mean that air defense is now a real issue in a way it wasn't, say, a decade ago, or that we didn't expect to. So a very big portfolio for the gentleman standing here to my right. Let me give you a brief bio, and then I'll turn it over to him. General Gene Renouart is the commander of NORAD and the United States Northern Command. He's a fighter pilot. That says it all, right? And
and good looking, I might add.
I told you. 60 combat missions, and he's commanded both squadrons and wings. He was the director of plans for NATO's combined air operations in Operation Denied Flight. He was commander of the Joint Task Force for Southwest Asia and the Operation Southern Watch. He was director of operations for U.S. Central Command for Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom. He was vice commander of the Pacific Air Forces out there in PACOM. He was appointed the director of strategic plans and policy at the Joint Staff. He was the senior military assistant to the Secretary of Defense. He's done basically everything. When you think about all the big conflicts, all the big potential conflicts, you've been there at some point, so that gives you a really unique perspective, and we're going to hear that today. He's been in command of NORAD and NORTHCOM since March of 2007, so a little bit of time to think things out. General, we're very happy to have you here today. Please come on up.
Thank you. Well, thanks very much, and I really appreciate the kind invitation to come and spend some time with you today. It's a little bit of the last man standing theory. Yes, you've had a lot of experience and exposure, and if you keep doing it long enough, eventually all of your competition begins to fall by the wayside. So, I won't say that it was all because of natural talent, skill, and good looks. A little bit, but not all. Great opportunity to be here with you today, and there are some very distinguished people in the audience, and I'm a bit humbled to be here speaking in front of all of you, because I know they are out there taking notes and said, why didn't I fire this guy when I had the chance? And so you missed your opportunity back then, and so now you're going to have to endure my comments today, and I hope they're helpful and meaningful for you. You heard that we have a complex world, and there is no doubt about that. We live in times today that are challenged in a number of ways. Nation-state competitors that we have seen for many years have been traditional for us are still there to differing degrees. Non-nation-state competitors are there in the economic world, in the cyber world, and in the security world. Terrorism continues to be a threat. And so what I'd like to try to do today is try to pull all that together and talk a little bit about how we manage that in the homeland, talk about some of the challenges that we see, and then I'm going to tease you with some topics that I hope will generate some questions, and then also maybe transition to the great panel that follows right after my comments and allow that discussion to continue. I won't claim to be a visionary, but I'll try to use some vision in my comments so that you see the world a little bit through my lens as we look to the kinds of threats that we see out there in the future. But before that, I think it's important or maybe helpful to talk a little bit about the two commands just to kind of put some perspective on it. This is it may be one of the best marriages of two commands you could possibly have. And If you think back to September 11th, we had a divorce of two commands, U.S. Space Command and NORAD. Those two resided under the hat of a single commander. We split U.S. Space off, created Air Force Space, U.S. Strategic Command, and then created U.S. Northern Command from that. That proved to be a pretty visionary move, and I'll talk a little bit about why that is. I'm not sure we realized it at the time, but today I can tell you that those two commands are tied together in a way that is extremely important for the nations of U.S. and of the U.S. and Canada, and for our nation in terms of providing coherent homeland security, homeland defense, and civil support. As was mentioned, NORAD is has been around a while. 51 years the command has existed since as of May this past year, and it began with a simple mission to defend the U.S. against the Soviet manned bomber threat back in the 50s, and it was pretty singularly focused. Northern radar sites looking up over the Arctic to ensure that we could warn of an incoming Soviet bomber equipped with a nuclear weapon. That mission has evolved immeasurably since then. Today, our missions of aerospace warning and airspace control and maritime warning are much more complicated than they were in that early day. Aerospace warning is about detecting and monitoring our aerospace activities. And as I said, in fact, even up until September 10th, 2001, that system was designed to look outside the borders of our country. We realized on September 11th that the threat can come from within the borders of our country. And so we've had to refocus that mission over the last few years to ensure that as good as we were at looking outside our borders, we had to be that good and better looking inside the borders. And today we have our alert fighters stationed across the U.S. and Canada monitoring air traffic approaching our nation's borders from external sources, as well as internal to the in the national aerospace systems of the U.S. and Canada, to ensure that any aircraft that is not complying with the rules of the road of our national aerospace system are identified, their intentions are understood, and that we take appropriate action to ensure they don't become a threat. Last year, 278 aircraft were identified as being what we call a target of interest. That means they're not doing something right in our national aerospace system. They're not talking. They're not using their IFF transponder codes. They're not following their flight plan. A variety of things like that that cause concern. And again, as I said, on September 10th, 2001, we didn't necessarily have that same focus. And we certainly didn't have the capacity to respond across the nation in the way we have today. I mentioned those 278 targets last year. 78 of those, we actually scrambled fighters to intercept. 52 or 3, I can't remember the exact number, were diverted to a suitable airfield where 50 or 60 of that pilot's closest law enforcement friends could meet and greet them and determine what it was they were doing and why. Now, the good news is none of those were terrorist-related. The better news is that most of those were simple mechanical failure that required the aircraft to divert into an alternate airfield. The best news is we were there for each one of them. We were there in a position where we could prevent them from taking the kinds of actions that we saw terrorists take on September 11th. That mission of aerospace warning and then aerospace control has grown substantially. You may have recalled an event just a couple months ago of a young man who stole a light aircraft in Canada, flew it down into the U.S., flew all the way down to southern Missouri, notionally attempting to commit suicide. He believed that NORAD would shoot him down, and he could commit suicide by having NORAD do that. Well, certainly we have that capability, and each of our fighters are armed every day as we fly, but we also have a process of command and control and communication and coordination that allows us to learn a lot about that person as this event is occurring, and making sure that we make a very deliberate decision to intervene, as you would imagine, the use of military in the homeland against a civilian aviator will be a significant event. So we want to do that with good cause, and we want to be able to collaborate with all the pieces. On September 10th, the NORAD command center did not have an FAA representative in it. TSA did not exist. We did not have an ability to reach into law enforcement in the way we do today. On that call a couple months ago, I was talking to FAA, TSA, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, NAV Canada, certainly the White House, the Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security. In fact, Secretary Napolitano, who was pretty new in her job at that time, called me a couple times to say, tell me again how you work this. And we were able to have this dialogue while this event was occurring, while we had fighters, and by the way, while we had Customs and Border Patrol shadowing this guy as he continued south. The good news is it ended safely. This guy finally decided that he was about to run out of gas and that these NORAD guys weren't going to shoot him down, and he didn't probably have the courage to do it to himself, and so he landed on a small road in Missouri. Interestingly, when he landed, I was talking on this conference call to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police hostage negotiators who were with this guy's ex-girlfriend who was texting him on his cell phone to say, land safely, don't go anywhere, someone will be there. And we were able to hand this event over to law enforcement in a safe way to end this situation. Doesn't say every situation will end so positively, but it does say that we've begun to build the links, the coordination efforts, the opportunity to have this discussion, to have a good understanding of the intentions of this aircraft, and then take action should that be needed. The final mission of NORAD is that of maritime warning, and this mission was added in the last negotiation of the terms of reference for the NORAD agreement. And, you know, you took an organization that was primarily air and space focused, and you said, now you're going to provide maritime warning for the governments of the United States and Canada. Good thought. The execution of that has taken some time to make it effective, because there is a the implied task there is an understanding of, a participation in, a collection of the right kinds of intelligence that points towards a vessel of interest on the high seas, military or civilian, and targets either law enforcement or military action on it to ensure that a threat doesn't come in. At the same time that was occurring, we've expanded our participation, we, the Department, Department of Homeland Security, others, through this collaborative effort in the container security initiative around the world to ensure that before containers leave other countries, they are inspected, and we understand what's aboard those things as they're headed this way. But similarly, now through the Maritime Operational Threat Response phone call process, or MOTR, I'll sit on a phone call with DHS, with the Commandant of the Coast Guard, with the Navy, with embassies in some cases, to determine that a ship has a potential threatening person or piece of cargo, where it is, who's the company that's shipping it. We get access into that information from our commercial shipping partners, and it's allowed us to fuse that information together in a way that we have the opportunity to interdict those ships at sea before they come into our ports. And that's a huge mission that is growing in its capacity every day. Now, those are the missions of warning that I described for you for NORAD. NORAD does have that execution mission of airspace control, but at the same time, NORAD is an active participant in ballistic missile defense. They provide that space situational awareness, that warning of an event that may threaten our country. U.S. Northern Command, in my U.S. hat, is responsible for executing a missile defense engagement by our ground-based mid-course interceptors in Alaska or Vandenberg. And so there is this relationship between the warning, the binational command of NORAD, and then the U.S. national command that executes activities on behalf of the government of the U.S. Interestingly, in my NORAD hat, I also have the responsibility for recommending execution of certain missions, intercept missions, on behalf of the government of Canada, which is a unique relationship in this particular set of two commands. Now, you all know the events that caused U.S. Northern Command to be formed, the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the crash of Flight 93 in Philadelphia, signaled to the U.S. that there were threats out there that were not unique as nation states. They were organizations, extremists, that were trying to find ways to hold us at risk in a variety of environments. And that was the first time we had seen in our country a civilian airliner used as a weapon with mass effect. So leadership at the time in our government made, a good decision to establish a unified combatant command focused on the homeland defense and the support to civilian authorities within our country to ensure that we could have a coherent effort to provide for the defense of our nation. It's the missions of defense are the principal reason we exist. Missile defense, response to a weapon of mass destruction, preparation for anticipation of hopefully deterring but also defeating a terrorist attack that may occur. All of those are roles that Department of Defense has an important part to play. In some cases, as the supporting department. In some cases, as the supporting department. And it's important to understand the differences of the two, because DOD doesn't have the role to do everything in the homeland. Department of Homeland Security equally stood up at the same time, has a role and a lead role in most cases to provide for the enforcement in the security or for the security of our nation. And so this marriage that had occurred back in 2002 or so as DHS and NORTHCOM stood up has grown over time to become a very successful partnership, both in the areas of Homeland Security, DHS supporting in Homeland Defense, and DOD supporting in disaster response and civil support. Everything NORTHCOM does is done within the framework of the Constitution. And I say that because there are some who believe that somehow we have created this command to exercise military authority in the homeland. And that is not the case. National Guard has constitutional authority to provide on behalf of the governor law enforcement capability. But the Title 10 military does not. And trust me, I got about 16 lawyers that follow me around every day just to make sure that I don't trip over that line. And the art form in this is to ensure that you can be leaning on the edge of that precipice to provide the right support, but not trip off and invade the rights and safeties that are guaranteed by our Constitution to our civilians. So our forefathers were pretty smart as they wrote that Constitution, and it provides for shared responsibility between the states and the federal government. And the art form in our business is to ensure that we maneuver that area in a way that protects the rights of our population, but also protects the safety that they so greatly deserve. As much as DOD sort of has this maybe reputation of wanting to be in charge, in this area we are careful to understand there's very few places where we are really in charge, and many, many places where we are very actively in support. And I'll talk a little bit about those as we move on here. Now, in the intro, you heard that I'm a fighter pilot, and a good-looking one, too, I might add. So thank you very much for mentioning that. But fighter pilots are not known for their prowess at extemporaneous and detailed public speaking. So the best way I can help you understand what we do each day is maybe to run a little video. And so I'm going to get my able-bodied aid here to make this work. And I'm going to run a short video just to kind of capture some of the broad variety of missions that we're involved with each day.
That the continental United States will be assigned a commander for the Northern Command. Thank you.
Secondly, is we live in a real time of change, and I don't think there's a command in the United States of America that is more representative of that change.
No two sovereign nations in the world, except for Canada and the United States, have such a unique command structure.
Well, 2 points before I continue on with my comments. First, you saw the great partnership displayed there between the United States and Canada, and I must tell you that that military-to-military and national partnership is as strong as it has ever been. It continues to be a very active relationship, not just in our headquarters, but as you know, the Canadians are fighting aggressively alongside us in Afghanistan. Our Canadian partners have invested about 127 or 28 of their officers and chief warrant officers to integrate into our headquarters each day. And as I am conducting my U.S. national mission for missile defense, my Canadian deputy is conducting the NORAD mission of aerospace and space warning. So while the nations are not partners in missile defense, the nations partner in the warning of assessment of threats from space and from potential missile attacks. So it's a great partnership and it works very well. And I've been very pleased with the teamwork that we've received from our Canadian friends. I mentioned both of these commands were kind of pulled together in the midst of a crisis, and in many cases, they didn't know how to operate together. They had no history of it, and so we had to grow a relationship over time. My predecessors, Ed Eberhardt and Tim Keating, really were challenged with creating the structure that would make these two organizations operate together. I was lucky. They got a lot of that done. And so our focus has been, how do you integrate them in a way that makes them an operational command every day? And it's them and it's a command. We've tried to pull these two together in a way that integrates key functions so that we maintain the unique nature of the binational command that is NORAD, but we integrate it with the unique requirements of the U.S. national mission, by the way, and the Canadian national mission with our counterpart Canada Command, for the two countries north and south of our border. It's a great relationship. It's one that grows every day. It faces a series of changing and uncertain threats spanning across all domains, space, land, sea, air, and cyber. As you know, whereas the enemies of yesterday were somewhat predictable, they were homogeneous, they were hierarchical, and in some cases slow to make big changes, today's adversaries are unpredictable, they're diverse, they're learning adversaries, they benefit from the technologies we all have become dependent upon, and they benefit from the fact that materials are readily available around the world that could cause us harm. And so the focus on both proliferation and the emphasis on non-proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and the materials it takes to produce them is increasingly important to us. Our enemies are not always military to military. They don't always follow conventional laws, and they certainly don't believe in the law of armed conflict. Globalization is a wonderful thing for the economy, but it also creates opportunities for ill to come to us. Globalization can accelerate the spread of disease, and we saw that with the recent H1N1 event that has occurred. And by the way, it's not done. We ought not to believe that it's ebbing now. If you look at, and I'll talk about it a little later, but if you look at the 1918 H1N1, it came back with a vengeance in the winter, and I think our nation is posturing itself well to be ready for that as the flu season comes in the fall. But in addition to spreading disease, those ingredients required to fabricate a weapon of mass destruction, those ideological elements that would create extremists move within that same global world, and certainly terrorism has taken advantage of that to move people and money around the world to hold countries at risk. Let me talk a little bit about our region, Mexico. First, I would say that the U.S. and Mexico, from a military-to-military standpoint, have the best relationship I think we've had in history. When I took command from Tim Keating, I made an appointment to go down to Mexico, and Tim warned me. He said, I've only been able to get in to see the commander of the Navy in Mexico, Semar. Had a tough time getting in to see the commander of the Army, Sedena. Interesting, in Mexico, both of them are considered secretaries of defense, so it's kind of a unique relationship there. Well, in this interim between Tim Keating and me, President Calderon came in, he changed the leadership, and he changed the culture of the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico in terms of the military. Not only did I get to see both, they both called and said, please, I want to talk to you as soon as you get to Mexico City. Both of them, in the very first meeting, said, we need to move forward with the United States military to help us as we fight these narco-terrorists in our country. That was a historic event, and we have tried to take advantage of that to provide assistance to the Mexican military over time. President Calderon clearly understands that narcotics trafficking is a strategic threat to his country. It is not a threat to take over the government of Mexico. These cartels are not interested in running the government of Mexico. They're interested in making money. They're in business. And so they're looking to exclude government as an influencer over their operations. And so you see very ugly action taken to threaten and intimidate government officials, their families, and the like, not to take over that role, but to push government aside so that they can keep the preeminent role that they want in terms of growing and expanding their business. Mexico is fighting that fight, and it's doing it well. They've made significant successes. They've had significant success in the last 7 months, in interdicting drugs and stopping some of that flow. And in fact, the price on the U.S. street now is up. The supply is down. The cartels are actually beginning to take after each other to help increase their own market share. And so while it is violent for sure, and certainly it is concerning along our border, the Mexicans understand this is a problem they have to solve and are getting after it. They're rejuvenating their federal police. They're expanding the equipping of their military. They are collaborating with us on information sharing, on training and tactics and techniques and procedures so that they can build the capacity of their military. And certainly the Merida Initiative was a great first step. That needs to continue, and I continue to make that point with all in Congress. Now, in there is also a DOD role along the border on our side. Many of you have heard public statements about increasing kidnappings, murders along the border, and certainly intimidation of Mexican officials who have moved their families across. DOD has a role to play, a unique role. And our Joint Task Force North, established down at El Paso, Texas, partners with the Department of Homeland Security, primarily CBP, but many others as well, in providing unique capabilities that improve law enforcement's ability to get their job done. You saw the benefit of some of that just a week or two ago when you may have seen pictures on the news of a tunnel that was detected in Arizona, and they were digging down in there to try to find the entrance and exit of that tunnel. Well, that tunnel detection technology is something that the DOD developed in Afghanistan and Iraq some time ago. We partnered with national labs and the Navy and others to help improve that technology, and we're using that to support Customs and Border Patrol and DEA and others as they combat the smuggling activity. So DOD doesn't lead in that role. We provide some pretty good technology that assists. And that's a role that I'm very comfortable with as Commander Northern Command, and I think the department has been comfortable with over the last couple years. We continue to find ways like that we can enable our federal partners in providing improved border security and to help to restrict the flow of illegal guns, money, and people across our borders. While we are concerned that terrorists might try to use these avenues to bring a threat into the homeland, we have a good relationship both with Mexico and with our intelligence partners to hopefully get the right information on a threat like that and be able to interdict it before it becomes real. One of the real challenges that Mexico has is the influx of weapons into their country. And you've heard a number of leaders of government talk about the fact that many of those weapons come from the United States. I don't know that I have data that can be that specific, but I will tell you that many of the weapons that I've seen as I've viewed the caches that have been taken by Mexican law enforcement and military do have a source that either came from the U.S. or was marketed through the U.S. For a long time, the Mexican government kept all of those weapons under the control of Sedena, their military. And they did not release the forensics of that data to our U.S. law enforcement folks, partly because of the cultural differences that they have within their own government. But we've been able to intercede to some degree to help with that. And ATF has a project called Gunrunner, which has been increasingly successful. And as the Mexican Army seizes the weapons, they now report that to the defense attaché, who reports to the U.S. ATF agent that is in the embassy. And information that's been received from this has allowed us to apprehend a number of illegal dealers here in the U.S. In fact, since the beginning of 2009, 1,400 defendants have been referred for prosecution involving over 12,000 weapons. So we are having an effect, and the Mexicans greatly appreciate that, and we continue to grow that capacity each day. Things like firearms identification, tracing, explosive identification, post-blast investigations, all those things are done now more collaboratively and allow U.S. law enforcement to be more effective in the work that it has on the north side of the border. So as you see, we work closely with the Department of Homeland Security each day, and that has been a relationship that has also grown maybe to the best that's ever been in history. Secretary Chertoff, Secretary Napolitano have both reached out to us actively, and within the provisions that we have in law, within the authorities that the Secretary has given us, we are able to provide support to those law enforcement, to those Homeland Security, to those disaster response organizations in a great way. Well, I'd like to maybe transition just a little bit and talk. That's a lot about what we've been doing today. I'd like to maybe talk a little bit about tomorrow and maybe try to tease you on some areas that will help maybe generate a question or two and certainly questions for me, but then maybe for the panel discussion that follows. I've talked about the future and the adversaries that we see out there. We are clearly in a persistent struggle against violent extremists. These extremists use both hard and soft power to hold us at risk. We have to be better at using both hard and soft power to defend ourselves and to eliminate them. Both of the last two secretaries of defense have made strong points, actually both at Kansas State University, which is a great speakers forum, had made the point that the U.S. needs to continue building capacity, especially in State Department, but in many of the other departments of government, so that we can be more active and more successful in that so-called Phase 4 area of operations overseas. I would argue that that same approach needs to be taken in the homeland. We need to ensure that CBP and ICE and ATF and DEA and FEMA and other departments within the Department of Homeland Security are funded adequately so that they can do the job they've been given. It should not be that we have to always rely on the Department of Defense to fill some needs. We need to continue to build that capacity. In today's economy, there's not going to be enough dollars to go around everywhere we'd like. And so we've got to use them smartly. We've got to make sure that we invest in the right economic strategy, the right educational professional development strategies for each of those departments, and the ability to operate more effectively in an interagency process. One of the speakers on your panel has some great experience in the interagency process, and there's been much written in the press about the success or lack of success in the interagency. I'm not an expert at that. I have sat in a few hundred meetings in Washington, and I can tell you that it is challenging within the Beltway to make that interagency process as effective as it needs to be. What we've tried to do out in our world is to take it down from the strategic to the operational level and integrate every day those same players in our planning, in our operations, in our execution, in our logistics, in our intelligence, in our communications, in our cyber defense. And it gives us a window into each of those departments in a way that is unique. That interagency process works very well every day. You see it at Northern Command. You see it at Southern Command. We're beginning to see that grow into reality at Africa Command. Tim Keating is working that hard in Pacific Command. So each of the combatant commanders understands the importance of that and are looking for ways to grow that capability and effectiveness. The challenge is there's not a lot of bench strength, not in terms of quality, in terms of numbers. And so it's hard for each of those departments who didn't grow up that way to be able to invest in each of the combatant commands in a way that really would be most effective. And so we've got to continue to grow and develop the leaders. My view, if you work in pick a department, you ought to have as a part of your professional development the responsibility and requirement to go work somewhere else as you grow up in the ranks. So that for you to be an assistant secretary in one of our departments, you had better gone out into a joint environment, an interagency environment, and spent 2 or 3 years so that you understand how important that relationship is. Those kinds of education, professional development opportunities will help us get past the interagency challenges that we have each day. We've all watched our 401ks and other funds go down. Mine's pretty meager to start with, but it's way meager right now. Clearly, the economy is driving us to a different state than we've been in for quite a while. I think there is a new normal that we are in. I don't know that we're going to see the stock market back to 14,000. I'm not an expert, and I've invested very poorly. But I think we need to understand that we're in a different economic environment today than we've been in many other times, and that we have an opportunity as well, though, to take advantage of that. We need to understand that interdependence among nations globally is the way of the future. I think we need to understand that defense dollars around the world are going to be tough to come by, that we can't solve a problem just as a defense department. We've talked about that before. You have to have a whole of government, and I would argue a whole of nations approach in many cases to solving some of the challenges that we have. Energy demand is going to continue to grow. The production and the security of that energy is going to cause us challenges. I'm equally concerned about energy security as a homeland defense element as I am about a nation state. It's smart. I have to pay attention to that. So we have to find ways to better secure the grids that we use to move our energy around. Cyber is clearly a threat. It's at the core of everything we do, and yet it is one of the things that is maybe not easiest to get into, but certainly whether you're a nation state or a young kid with torn blue jeans and flip-flops on, you can find vulnerabilities in the system and take advantage of them. We have got to, as a nation, close those gaps, close those vulnerabilities. And it's got to be done not by DOD. It's got to be done by the entire government. DHS is growing their capacity to provide for policy in cybersecurity for the nation. They've got to continue to grow the muscle underneath that. That's got to be funded. That's important for our nation to commit to. I think this administration is doing that, but we are, I think, lacking in capacity across many areas of government because it's not just about DHS and DOD. That's the .gov and the .mil world, but most of you and we operate in .mil, .gov, .com, .net, .edu, and pick some others. How do we ensure that we maintain the access we need to information, the situational awareness we need? I need every day from local responders at a disaster to air defenders flying around the country. I've got to be able to fuse that information together and give me decision quality information like that. And I've got to protect it and ensure that the right people get the right access. Huge challenge, and one that the nation, it's not that we don't understand it, it's we're still building capacity to do that, and we've got to continue it. Interesting relationships, as I talked about, with Mexico and with Canada. Increasingly, we are seeing an interest in a north-south relationship to ensure that our transnational threats like narcotics, like illicit human trafficking and others are focused on, that our borders are secure, and yet they're open. We have, for some time, have had separate organizations focused on countering narcotics trafficking within our country. JIATF South, I have JTF North, there is a JIATF West. I believe it's time, and Admiral Thad Allen, the Commandant of Coast Guard, and I have talked about this a great bit. I believe it's time to begin to think about a national task force for counter-trafficking and forming that in a more integrated fashion so that we look at borders north and south, east and west, and ensure that we have an integrated effort to attack that trafficking problem. Speaking of North, the Arctic's up there, and it's melting. Now, I don't know why. I'm not smart enough to have a good understanding of what causes all of that, and I think there will be studies that will continue on in that regard. But the fact of the matter is, each year, over the last 15 years, there has been more navigable water in the Arctic than we've seen in the past. Last year, as a matter of fact, there were 18 cruise ships that chose to take the Northwest Passage. If nothing else, sooner or later, one of them is going to break down. Are the Arctic nations prepared to do search and rescue of a large scale? Are the Arctic nations prepared to manage the exploration for natural resources in that area? Are the Arctic nations partnering in a way that can ensure that competition for resources doesn't become security competition between nations? Those are questions that are being discussed actively in the Arctic Forum among many of the Arctic neighbor nations, but it is an area that we have to continue to focus on. I think it will become more important. And I'm not worried that tomorrow we're going to have a whole bunch of container ships choose to go that way, because it requires a substantial investment in both equipment, safety, technology, and the like. But I am concerned that the U.S. has not operated in that region actively for a while from the security standpoint. Canada, similarly, is interested in operating in that area more. This is an area of collaboration that I think we need to focus on. I mentioned the H1N1 virus a little bit ago. We don't know when a pandemic will hit, although the World Health Organization just declared phase 6, which means this is a pandemic. Again, I'm not a technical expert, but I will tell you that there are similarities in every outbreak of a viral nature in our history. We have an initial spurt. It tends to drop off a bit. As the virus mutates a bit during the southern season, it comes back with a vengeance in the fall. I think Department of Homeland Security, HHS, and others are actively working this. I think we are doing a good job of preparing for the return of this in the fall as it comes. We don't know to what degree. But I will tell you that you may recall the 1918, I mentioned the H1N1 iteration. It killed more people than were lost in World War I. 50 million dead worldwide estimated, 600,000 in the U.S., 47,000 of them were military. Now, that doesn't mean this one's going to be that way, and I don't mean to say that. I just mean to say that we need to remain focused on the planning, the preparation for a return of this kind of activity in the winter season. And I think we've got all the departments of government now clearly focused on that. And CDC and HHS are developing vaccine preparations, and we'll all get a couple flu shots probably in the fall to ensure we're ready. But I encourage all of you to take the precautions that are necessary to prevent that kind of a virus from affecting you. And that prevent word is important. When I took command, I added one word to the mission statement, and it was anticipate. And it forces you to think differently about planning and preparation and prevention. It forces you to think about something called resiliency. I bet if I went around the room and asked how many, I won't ask you to raise your hand, but if I did, and I said, how many of you have a family evacuation plan, how many of you have a family resiliency plan, we might not pass the test. And yet that's the most important first step. But then it's important in communities. It's important in states. It's important in FEMA regions. It's important for the Department of Defense. We have not committed yet to that national resiliency, and we need to continue to move forward on that. And that will help us when we see a recurrence of something like H1N1. We have to prepare ahead of time. We saw at Katrina, when the catastrophic event occurred and the dike and the levees and dikes all that broke fell, we really hadn't done a good job of putting together the integrated plan ahead of that time. So we put, my words now, we put mass on the target. 72,000 military, another 30 or 40,000 civilian responders. We put mass on the target down there. And it was effective for sure. Wasn't as well integrated as we'd like for it to be. Today, we're able to put precision on the target. We've done the integrated gap analysis in each of our FEMA regions. We've spent time with each state in the hurricane-prone states to ensure we knew what they know, We knew what they can do, and we know now what they might need. Each year, the Secretary of Defense signs for me a Defense Support of Civil Authorities Execute Order. It gives me authority to reach into the Department of Defense and pull out those unique capabilities that we'll need to respond to a disaster. Those changes have come about evolutionary over time since NORTHCOM was stood up. But it's that kind of planning, preparation ahead of time, understanding what the gaps and vulnerabilities are ahead of time, that allows us to be much more precise in putting capability on target. The best example I've seen was Hurricane Gustav last year. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, landfall was 11 o'clock that coming night. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we looked at the TV cameras. By the way, we could see the TV cameras, which was something we couldn't do in Katrina, at NORTHCOM and at DHS, and we were all looking at it together. We could see the TV cameras, the traffic cameras in New Orleans, and there were two cars on the streets. There were no people, two cars on the street. Police car and a National Guard Humvee. People left. They understood the importance of evacuation. They left in a way that was effective. Train, boats, planes, we moved them all out. Critical care patients, DOD led the way in moving them out of New Orleans and got them out of harm's way into safety. And people were confident enough to leave because law enforcement and the National Guard were in place. So we've made great progress in that regard, and it's something that I'm very, very pleased with. There's lots and lots of topics to talk about. We can talk about ballistic missile defense, catastrophic nuclear, biological, chemical events, air and space defense. We've talked about cyber a little bit. All of those pose us challenges for the future, and we have to find a way collaboratively to work through them. It is all about leadership in an interesting mega community. I don't own any of those forces that are contributed to by even DOD. I don't own very many of them on a day-to-day basis, but I have to have them ready. I certainly don't command or control the Guard, the Reserve. Well, I command the Reserve, the Guard, or the federal partners at play. And yet all of us have a vested interest in being successful and effective. And so you have to create this community of collaboration and coordination, communication, and integration that can be successful. That's my simple little world every day. And it's one that I'm increasingly finding success is really sweet to come by, because you see the smiles on the faces of our best customers, those kids you saw in there, as we do what we're supposed to do, and that's guarding what each of you value the most, your communities. So I appreciate the time to be with you, and I'm looking forward to your questions. Thank you very much. Yes, sir. Okay, Mitzi, go ahead.
I'm with the Sobrowski Institute at the Naval Postgraduate School,
yes.
And I run an energy seminar here in Washington for everybody funded by DOD. I'm really interested in this question of anticipation.
Uh-huh.
I worked on Y2K with Sobrowski. Y2K went remarkably well. When it was all over, they said, it's no problem. My God, we did a lot of work. And there's no credit for preventing a fire. You only get credit if you put the fire out. And we have a lot of firefighters in this city and sort of in the high levels. How do you deal with that? How do you reward anticipatory behavior?
You don't beat them as much. that is a challenge, and it truly, you have to make sure that the partners you deal with understand how important that anticipation really is, and that your reward for success is that nothing happens. All of us want to be rewarded with feedback, and so part of what I try to do is talk to our partners, build confidence with them, spend time saying thank you with them, talk to our staff when nothing does happen, to talk about the importance of what we did to ensure that. That picture in New Orleans was worth a million words, because there were not people in harm's way, and we were lucky. The hurricane wasn't quite as bad as it could have been, but we can't afford to just be lucky. We've got to be good, and good means out in front of things. That's true for terrorism, that's true for cyber, that's true for natural disaster. And so, will we be successful at everything? No, we're human. We'll fail sometimes, we'll fall short sometimes. But that one word has really changed the culture of our headquarters and the way we interact with our federal partners. And I think our feedback has been very positive from each of those. I got three cameras out here that are helping me right now, too. Thank you.
Tim Davidson with NDIA. Good to see you again. The question is, what does NORTHCOM hope to get out of the QDR? And can you specifically address how unmanned air systems may play in your future?
Sure. QDR provides us a real opportunity to think of, it goes back a little bit to anticipation. What is your world going to look like out there, and then how do you program to it? And so from my perspective, I want to make sure that the nation continues to recognize the importance of defense of the homeland and of the role that DOD can play in both homeland security and civil support. Now, you also have to do that understanding that there's only so many budget dollars. And so how we cut and shape those will drive us to consider risk, to consider programs over a long term, and make judgments about whether they are affordable and in the best interest and meet the security needs of our country. There's give and take in all that. So actively playing in that is a principal role that we have. And I've been pleased so far. Secretary Gates has made a particular comment to say, I want the combatant commanders involved. I've got about 20 people that are sitting in the committees, the working groups, each day. Certainly our focus is on areas where missile defense, air sovereignty alert, homeland defense, Saberni, nuclear, biological, chemicals, consequence management is a player. Those areas, and by the way, they're not just in the homeland. We can support in other places as well. So if I begin to see risk develop or being assumed, I want to make sure that people have the right assumptions. A great mentor a few years ago said to me, you better look at your assumptions first. In fact, I took a few beatings because I hadn't quite done that from time to time. And so we want to make sure the assumptions we have about threat and risk are right. Now, there's a separate decision that says how far can we go with all of that? How much can we spend? How much can we commit to? That's a different part of the QDR process. It's sort of the product. And I think as long as we're doing our best to ensure that we describe risk, we describe consequences, then political leaders will take that in and make determinations about how they shape the future for the department. And I'm not uncomfortable with that process right now. Oh, unmanned air systems. Yeah, great. Oh, no, you're going to stand up and I'm going to sit you back down. It's okay. I got a couple more minutes. How am I doing, Marin? Okay. Unmanned systems are great. They have unique capabilities. For example, we use the infrared sensors on the Global Hawk to help us find hot spots in wildfires in California last year and the year before. But we don't want to make them the centerpiece of everything we do. I can also fly a light airplane over some of those and in some cases find that same target. So what we have to be able to do is ensure that unmanned capability is integrated with manned capability in the air or on the ground in a way that is value added as opposed to just pursuing a program. And we're trying to do that pretty hard. Now, the other piece that I do play a big role in is integrating the use of unmanned systems into our national aerospace system. We hosted a great gathering with the FAA, partnered with the FAA in March this past year, or this year, to talk about how do we better do that so that when we do need to fly them, we don't have to refly them and fly them in restricted airspace. We can integrate them into the national aerospace system in a way that's safe. And by the way, do that with Canada as well. So we have two roles to play in the UAV world. One more question. Yes, sir.
Homeland Security Today magazine. What are your thoughts on a cyber command and its relationship with NORTHCOM? How does that work?
Well, I'm a consumer of cybersecurity. I have within my headquarters, my information technology team is focused on the security of my internal networks. But importantly, I'm a consumer of national cybersecurity. And so I believe it's important for us to have a command focused on, from DOD, focused on cybersecurity. But that command has to be able to work in an integrated way with the Department of Homeland Security, in an integrated way with the private sector, because they own many of those other networks out there. Academia, who owns that .edu, they've got to participate, and there's many players there. So this is one of those that truly is a whole-of-government problem. And I sort of have the luxury of saying, you know, fix me and put that demand signal. So my principal role is to ensure that the elements of security for the cyber domain that I am most dependent upon are made more secure every day. And I probably have the most diverse set of cyber domains to deal with of any of the combatant commands because of our private sector participation, because of our participation with the civilian emergency management agencies who operate in an unclassified world. So I'm a loud squeaky wheel in that process, but I don't own the forces to fix it, and I'm not sure I really want to. I think we're doing the right thing by focusing that effort in a global command capability that can then reach out and help people like me or Tim Keating or soon-to-be Jim Stavridis in Europe or Skeet Frazier down at Southcom. And I think I'm comfortable with that. Now, again, as I said earlier, we need capacity there, both in the military and in the civilian sectors. And so growing those professionals who can operate in that environment is important. Look, I appreciate the chance to chat. I'm sorry for taking extra time, but you've got a great panel coming on. I'm going to stick around the back for a little bit and make faces at them in case they get me in trouble. Thanks very much.
Great job.
Appreciate it, Jim.
Well, it really is comforting to see somebody who's both energetic and thoughtful in charge. The line I remember best is the 16 lawyer lines. Remember when LIC was low-intensity conflict, and I guess now it's lawyer-intensive conflict. We've gotten a clear message from DOD. We had the general yesterday. We had the deputy secretary of defense on what their
Hi,
role
Mitzi,
is.
Hi, do you have another question?
What they understand. It's addressing public concerns. Concerns might be a little overstated. It says something, though, that we had to create this command a few years ago, and the issues and the problems that led us to create this command aren't going to go away. So with that, what I hope we can do is bring up the panelists, if you can come on up now. What I'm going to do is introduce the moderator, who needs no introduction, but I'll still do it, and then she'll introduce the rest of the panelists. Come on up, guys. Gene Meserve, Washington-based correspondent for CNN, covers Homeland Security. I love her stuff. What more can I say? She's gotten so many awards. Award-winning coverage for Hurricane Katrina. David Bloom Award for extraordinary composure and compassion. I think you have an Emmy. Don't you have an Emmy? She has an Emmy. Yeah. I mean, it's just the list goes on and on. A couple Emmys. Oh, well. I won't read the whole list here, but you would recognize so many of these events that she was responsible for covering for CNN. But CNN always used to irritate me because when I was a kid in the Foreign Service, one of our goals was to beat CNN to see if we could get the news up before the... Sometimes, yes. But it decreased over time, I regret to say. Political reporting before that. And, of course, before CNN, she was at ABC where she was the State Department correspondent. And reported from some of the countries that we've been talking about from all over the world. With that, let me turn it over to Jean. She'll introduce a fabulous panel, and I will stand in the back and eat bacon.
And we're just going to prove that the general doesn't have a quarter on natural talent.
Introducing everybody. Oop, thank you. Do you think I'd know how to work a microphone, given what I do for a living? So. Just forget that. Okay. David Howes down at the end here. He's president and CEO of Civitas, providing homeland security consulting services to state, federal, and local governments, as well as private companies. Prior to that, he was a special assistant to the president and senior director for emergency preparedness and response at the White House Homeland Security Council. He was chief of staff to the president's Critical Infrastructure Protection Board. He was one of the principal authors of the 2003 strategy for securing cyberspace, and he came to all of that after 4 years as a special warfare officer in the U.S. Navy. He led a SEAL team during Operations Desert Storm and provide comfort. Mark Sox is also with us. He's Verizon's Executive Director of Government Affairs for National Security Policy, coordinating cyber policy issues relating to communications with federal, state, and local governments. He is a member of the recent noteworthy CSIS Commission on Cybersecurity. He's director of the SANS Internet Storm Center. In 2003, he was the National Cybersecurity Division of DHS. He was with them. Previous to that, he was on staff at the National Security Council, and with the President's Critical Infrastructure Protection Board, he had a 20-year career in the U.S. Army. And finally, Francis Fragos Townsend, now with Baker Botts LLP, is a crisis and risk consultant. She is probably well known to most of you as having been assistant to President Bush for Homeland Security and counterterrorism. She authored the White House follow-up report on the response to Katrina. She was Deputy National Security Advisor for Combating Terrorism. She was a first Assistant Commandant for Intelligence for the U.S. Coast Guard, and she spent 13 years at the Department of Justice in a variety of roles under Presidents Bush 1, Bush 2, and President Clinton. And I might also add she's now a contributor to CNN. We like to underline that one. I'd love to get each of you to react to what you heard or didn't hear in the General's comments. And David, why don't we start with you down at the end there?
Okay, I just want to pick up on a couple of things that the general said. I know that Fran and I shared a moment of remembering horror as part of the interagency process, or trying to corral some of the interagency processes as we worked at the White House together. And certainly, I think General Rignard is right that we have a lot of work to do there to make sure that we've got an effective approach to Homeland Security that encompasses all the agencies that are involved in it. Just to elaborate on that a little bit, as General Rignard showed the images of 9/11 in his video, and I think those are incredibly compelling and touch all of us when we see them. But we have also gotten farther and farther away from 9/11, and we've gotten farther away, and thanks to the good work of many that work in Homeland and National Security, we at least haven't had a major attack here in the U.S. And as we get farther away, the thought about that the potential for such an attack occurring vitiates a little bit over time. And we do see challenges in the budget as well for Homeland Security. From 2004 to 2009, it increased at about a 7 or 8% clip per year. And I think if you look at the projections going forward and recognizing that there's lots of priorities now for federal funding, and we are in the midst, as the general mentioned, of an economic downturn, that the projection for the forward-looking years probably won't be nearly so high as the growth rate has been in the past. And if you take those two things into account, then you need to make sure that you're being smart about where you're placing your bets in Homeland Security. And I feel like we've gone through sort of three phases of Homeland Security. We had the immediate reaction to 9/11. Where we built out TSA, we reacted to that specific event, made sure that it couldn't happen again, and began to put the institutions in place for a longer-term Homeland Security capability. We had a second phase, which was, in some sense, I'll call the post-Katrina phase. It was a phase focused on response, making sure that we were able to, in a more integrated, systematic way, deal with the types of natural threats that could occur in the homeland, and with a benefit to some degree to how we would respond to terrorism as well. And I think today we're entering into a third phase, a phase where we really need to focus on maturing and institutionalizing our Homeland Security enterprise. Because without that, as we get farther and farther from 9/11 and as budgets get more challenging, we won't have the systematic capacity in place to be able to ensure that there is intense, professional, on-the-edge approach to securing the homeland that there was right after 9/11 and I think has been up till now. And so I think one of the challenges as we go forward is how do we make sure that we've got a system in place, just like the Department of Defense has, that from year to year always is focusing on the needs and making sure that we are building the right Homeland Security enterprise. And I think a large part of that is something that the General alluded to, which is creating a better interagency process which uses common risk criteria to create a common budget It makes explicit trade-offs between what we will and will not fund to ensure that we're using the right levers to address the risk in each case. And we have multiple levers that we can address risk with, including prevention, protection, response and recovery investments. And we need to make sure that that's done in a systematic way, including DOD and DHS and all the other agencies that participate in Homeland Security. The other thing that I'd like to pick up on that the general mentioned was cybersecurity. If you look at one place where the budget isn't as challenged, it's cybersecurity. There's a major initiative, as I think all of you are aware, going on in the government to improve our cyber posture. And I think that this is going to be both a major area for government focus, but also a major challenge in the sense that it really encompasses the nation. It's an area that we have to, as General talked about, be able to encompass the .com domains and the commercial enterprises and the critical infrastructure, in addition to the intelligence community and DOD and Homeland Security. And as we try to address that, grand scale of problem, we're going to have to come up with improved ways of taking that on. And I'll just mention one now. Maybe we can get into it later. But I think one of the things that definitely needs to be done is to prioritize and perhaps narrow the target set for where we need to make the corrections. Because if we think of the problem as every company in the United States, every critical infrastructure node, every government agency, DOD and the intel community, and if we treated them all equally, the problem would be overwhelming. And so figuring out where our priorities lie and putting metrics against what is success in the cybersecurity realm is something that I think is key to our future.
Thank you. Let me limit myself to just three areas. My background is largely cyber and communications, and I'll talk a little bit about globalization, cybersecurity, and also the role of the private sector, because I heard the general say good things about all. Globalization is an area that we're very all aware of. There is no going backwards. All of our countries around the world are now interlocked. There is a strong desire in some places to pull some of this back to become more domestic, less international, but I think we all agree that's not going to happen. This has created a series of interdependencies that probably 15, 20 years ago we could see it coming, but we didn't understand what it was going to mean. Some odd things on the military side. For example, in a Cold War world, we fought each other with weapons and weapons systems that were designed, developed, and built in our home countries. In this new world that we live in, as we move more towards a highly connected world, many of our systems are designed and built and come from countries that may, in fact, be our adversaries or may someday be our adversaries. This raises the odd question of what do we do with the supply chain? How do we get things back and forth between countries that are highly connected? If we bring that into the cyber world, much of the software and hardware is made overseas. The very tools that we would use to defend ourselves or to conduct offensive operations are, in fact, developed in countries that we may, in fact, be hostile with either today or in the future. So this mindset of globalization is something we have to get our heads around. We have to think about that. We don't go backwards. It clearly is the future. For cybersecurity, this is an area that I've worked in for quite a number of years. And a lot of what we see today has been predictable. We knew back in the 90s that this was going to happen. We knew that cybercrime was going to grow. We knew that international espionage was going to grow. The role of the military has largely been unclear. In the 1990s, most of this was highly classified. You couldn't even talk about it except behind the proverbial green door. Things began to change in the late 90s as attacks became more well-known. The Joint Task Force for Computer Network Defense was established at the end of 98. I was part of that team. We started to bring some of this discussion out. September 11th, of course, was not a cyber attack. We thought that the next strike against our nation truly would be cyber. This was all the buzz here in Washington. Of course, the terrorists chose to attack us using aircraft, a physical type of attack. There was much concern about would there be a supporting cyber attack? Would round two come through the networks? Would it go against the critical infrastructures? So far, we've not seen that type of threat manifest itself. We've been very worried about disruptions in cyberspace. It hasn't really happened. But what we have seen is our adversaries, particularly the terrorists and others, taking advantage of the connected part of our nation to use it for money laundering, for raising money, for communications, for keeping in touch with themselves. As we have become dependent on cyberspace, so have our adversaries. And so this makes for an interesting role for the military and for the government in terms of protecting itself in cyberspace as well as protecting the United States citizens, our Constitution, and what makes us a country. When the JTF stood up at the end of 98, one of the questions we asked was, should we be like a NORAD in cyberspace? Should we protect North American cyberspace? And that was an interesting question. You know, should we build a shield around the United States and Canada because of our electrical interconnectivity? We thought about that a lot and realized that, no, the private sector has so much of a role here, and we're so interconnected and it's growing so fast that trying to do a cyber shield or something that's very similar to what NORAD provides on the aerospace side, while it sounds great and generates a lot of good sound bites, probably didn't make a lot of sense. And so it has, of course, evolved from there. And the private sector has continued to be increasingly important in this. And this is the third thing I'd like to just discuss briefly, is that NORTHCOM, as well as the other combatant commands of Homeland Security and the entire nation, is highly linked with the private sector. Several years ago, we identified 17 critical infrastructures and key resources. That's now been raised to 18 with the addition of critical manufacturing. There is a strong recognition from the federal government that the private sector and the critical infrastructures all together with the federal government provide the type of security we need here in the homeland. From a communications perspective, where I work at Verizon, we've had, and other comms companies have had, a longstanding relationship with the federal government, a partnering relationship, so that we work together to provide the resilience that the general was talking about, the support to the first responders, to public safety, to homeland, and to the military. I think in the future that relationship will continue to grow and continue to be strengthened, and I appreciate the recognition from the general that the private sector involvement is key to what we'll be doing in the coming decades.
Thanks, Gene. I think one of the things that was very interesting to me about the general's remarks, you heard him, just as Secretary Gates has advocated for additional investment and resources in the State Department, you heard the general advocate for additional resources and investment in DHS and building DHS capacity. The answer is, while noble, it is self-interested, and it is the result of some very painful lessons learned by DOD. And I don't think the general or former secretary who's no longer here would disagree with that. There's no question that when DHS, as it's standing up, building capacity, when it has faced a crisis that it has authority and responsibility to address but lacks the capacity, it breaks the glass and pulls the ripcord over at DOD. DOD's gotten real tired of that because fighting on two fronts in Afghanistan and Iraq, they have their capacity committed. And so to have this thrown on them without the requisite planning is a real difficulty and a real challenge. And so what we're seeing is, rightly, DOD advocating for civilian agencies to have the capacity that they require to execute their own mission so that they're not calling at the last minute on resources from DOD. You know, the other lesson I think we've learned over the last few years is, while the general's language about supporting and supported commands and homeland security and defense means a lot to my former colleagues in uniform, what they've also learned is it means almost nothing to those in civilian agencies. They just don't understand the language. They don't understand what comes with that and what doesn't come with that. And it's a bad time to be learning in the midst of a crisis. And so we do need to build civilian capacity. We do need to make the investment of resources, much along the way Dave Howe has suggested. We've got to do it in a mature way, looking across the spectrum of risk and where do we want to make those long-term investments. The general also talked about the improvements that have been made between coordination between NORTHCOM and DHS, and I think that's right. There were some painful lessons in Hurricane Katrina about what were the expectations of the civilian agency on the military. There are now things, you talked about the execute order that comes out annually. There are pre-scripted mission assignments so DOD can plan against what will be expected of them, what will they need to bring to that fight, and so that they can plan for that. That's great in terms of natural disasters. The question becomes, you've heard both the prior panelists talk about cyber. I would add to that WMD. Where are the pre-scripted mission assignments for that? Does DOD know clearly what the expectations are, what will be levied on them in terms of requirements, and how they can plan for it, the response to that? With WMD, of course, we have it runs the gamut from prevention to protection, detection, protection, recovery, response. What will be the requirements? Because once again, in a world of building capacity at DHS,
the resources and capacity mostly lie in DOD. And so we've got to be careful not to fall into the usual trap of fighting the last fight. That is, we had problems in terms of the response to Hurricane Katrina. We learned from them. We studied it. We put in prescripted mission assignments. We need to be thinking about what's the next fight, whether that's cyber or WMD. The one other thing that I'm going to call some two. The next one I would say is there was some discussion in the general's remarks about the role of the National Guard and Reserve. And while I think the coordination is better, let us not pretend that we have solved the many issues related to the use of the National Guard and Reserve. Clearly, I was recently at a military exercise. There is no question that if there is a threat that emanates overseas but may, in fact, impact the homeland, will governors in those circumstances release National Guard troops to be deployed forward for the offensive fight when the general and NORTHCOM have a responsibility here at home? And by the way, they've got to get the guard released from the governors who have control. So there are real issues about that. And I will tell you that it is a rightful concern of combatant commanders who will have responsibility to find forces to be able to fight the fight forward. And while he talked about better coordination, I suspect that we have not done all of the homework and thinking we need to do there. And then the last one, and I do this at some risk. It's the luxury of no longer being in the government. I can sort of say what I think. The general used, and I quote, because I took it down exactly, we are in a, quote, persistent struggle against violent extremists, end quote. Now, there is some press coverage in the prior administration about the use of the term struggle against violent extremists. And I am not one, I am not wedded to particular words. But I do think, and having been schooled by many of my colleagues in the military, words are important. We must understand who our enemy is. And if the struggle against violent extremists identifies it sufficiently for my military and law enforcement colleagues, okay. But I will tell you, persistent, I agree. Struggle, to me, connotes a conflict among equals. Not okay for me. This is a real conflict. Now, whether or not you call it a war, I'm not advocating the particular use of that word. But I think we need to be very careful about what it is we're engaged in, and I don't think it's a struggle. I think it's more than that. And is it against violent extremists? Well, yeah, I suppose. But who are they? Well, I will tell you, to use al-Qaeda as the prime example, there is no question that al-Qaeda has made perfectly clear their capacity to kill Americans on American soil, their intent to continue to try to kill Americans on American soil, their willingness to use weapons of mass destruction on American soil to kill Americans. They've issued fatwas. They've been very clear. Clearly, the enemy thinks it's at war with us. We better know what it is we're engaged in and what lengths we're willing to go to defeat them, and our language must be clear. I really am not advocating for particular terms, but it was funny when he said this persistent struggle against violent extremists, it's very Washington speak. I can say that having been in a public position, but I don't think it's clear enough for us to communicate to the American people whose support and confidence we must have to be successful in the fight.
Fran, thanks. We are all here to take your questions, so if anybody has one, oh, right away, great. Right here, why don't we start off?
Well, look, I think the word war has a loaded political context, you know, at this time. I certainly think we're in a conflict, and I think we should be clear it's a conflict. I think you can argue, as many will, that it is a war, in fact. We've got military assets deployed forward fighting to protect us, and I think war is a perfectly legitimate term to call it. That's why I say to you, I don't think it's a struggle, and I don't think that captures it correctly. You can call it a conflict. You can call it a war. My military colleagues will argue with me the difference, but I think we've got to be very clear about that it is, we are currently engaged in an armed conflict against extremists.
Other arms were up. Randy Larson, I see you. When you stand up, if you could tell us who you are, where you're from. Go ahead, Randy.
Thank you, Gene. Randy Larson, WMD Commission. I'll ask Fran, but I think both others might want to comment also. last week, Senator Bob Graham and Jim Talent, our chair and vice chair of the commission, wrote a letter to President Obama. It said their recommendation was that the WMD threat was so significant today, and it's going to get worse as we go forward without significant action. They recommended that the vice president take that mission on. And not only this vice president, but future vice presidents, that with the great challenges in the interagency community, that's the only way. And there's only two people in town, or two people in town that cabinet secretaries call sir, okay, that can tell the cabinet secretary what to do. What do you think about the vice president taking that lead? Or could it be moved down a level? Is it something that really General Jones could do? Or do you see an advantage in the vice president doing that?
My concern. Let me start with, you mentioned Jim Jones, the National Security Advisor. He's got more than he can say grace over. If we add one more thing to his plate, nothing's going to happen, right? So he is an incredibly talented, competent. I have enormous respect for him. Let me be clear. But you can't add one more thing to his plate. So that let's take that off. The advantage for those of you who've not worked in the belly of the beast that is the 18 acres that we call the White House. Is the vice president has a distinct role in the budget process. And so I will tell you there is an advantage in having it be the vice president, at least in, as the honorary chair of it, because ultimately, you know, what's important is where you spend money, and you want somebody who's got some control over the purse strings. The problem, I was an advocate in the prior administration, and I'm happy to see the establishment of a WMD czar in the White House. I'm not a fan of czars, by the way, but let's put that aside for a second. That there's a single point of accountability on the president's staff related to WMD, I think that's good. But if that person doesn't have authority of the cross-cut of the government's budget, you need the vice president to be able to do that. And so he's going to need somebody to run it day to day. But there is, I think, and Talent and Graham understand this as well as anybody in this town, that because of his budget authority, there is something to be gained by having it be the vice president. Mark or David, did you want to weigh in?
Just brief is I concur, but we need to also be careful that we choose very wisely, because there's so few tokens we can lay on that plate. If we give this to the vice president, what's next in line, and what's after that, and what's after that, and does it become bloated? If we can keep it to just the one or two with the budget authority, then that's I concur.
Yeah, let me just chime in as well. If there were one thing that you would say you should put that token on, it would probably be a terrorist attack with weapons of mass destruction. You can't think of anything that would be a worse catastrophe for the United States or a more important thing to try to prevent. The only implication I'd add to what Fran said, which I agree with, is you definitely do need the person at the lower level who's taking on the day-by-day plotting that has to go on to actually make this work. Most of the tasks in Homeland Security are not rapid response to an event. They're mostly getting ready, preparing, making sure we have the right defenses up. And that takes day-to-day persistence, somebody who's on top of the problem, can really work it, and has the staff to support them and can bring the agencies together. Whether the vice president could do that on a day-to-day basis, probably not. But he can add the clout and the heft that Fran said, which is also necessary when you get to those crucial battles where you need some budget or you need a program to actually make some progress.
Sure.
Agreeing on, it's not the day-to-day activities. I know the BP's got a lot of other things. But on those log jams and the budget, a $1.1 trillion stimulus package and $900 million for BARDA got dropped out because there was no champion for it. That wouldn't happen if the vice president was saying BART is important. And what, a week ago, they were trying to steal $3.3 billion out of BioShield, one of our most effective bio programs, to go pay for flu vaccine. I think we got that turned off now. But, I mean, those are the sorts of things, not the day-to-day activities, but the guy to break the log jams and to protect the important programs, whether it's nuke or bio.
I saw some other hands out here. Over here in the brown dress. It isn't just me. Okay. I'm so happy.
I'm on staff here at CSIS. Going back to the QDR, what should the QDR say about homeland defense, and what specific investments or disinvestments should be made?
Who wants to tackle that?
Go ahead.
You know, I don't know if I can fully address what the QDR ought to say about Homeland Defense. Clearly, the Department of Defense is going to have a major role here. I think I'd go back to some of Fran's comments that we need to make sure that we've addressed the full gamut of the types of things that, that could happen and how DOD would be intertwined in the prevention mission. If, you know, if at all, what is their role there? How would that work? And also in the response to some of these other possibilities beyond kind of a civil support role for Katrina. So what really are the mission assignments, or how will they really respond to a weapons of mass destruction event? And these are areas where I think implicitly people are relying on the Department of Defense right now because there really is no other alternative to be able to respond. And making that explicit and being clear about what resources that really takes, I think, is one of the crucial things that could be done.
For Homeland Defense, the main area that we are able to train is response to natural disasters, and these happen all the time. We have to be able to allow the National Guard, Reserve, and active components to interoperate freely, to train together, and to work together. All of you remember Hurricane Andrew long ago, long before there was a Katrina. Within hours of Andrew running across South Florida, essentially cutting down Miami and Homestead Air Force Base, 18th Airborne Corps was on the road, heading down Interstate 95, bringing in communications, water, relief, all types of things. So the importance there of the Defense Department when it comes to not just defending the homeland, but also doing emergency response is absolutely key. And we cannot lose that. And it provides a good training opportunity for the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. So should we get attacked at home, we've already got that interoperability, the intercommunications, and the ability to work with the Guard and Reserve as well as the active side.
I just take the opportunity to mention, and David said what I would have said, which was about, you know, we got to figure out what are the requirements that will be levied on DOD so they can plan for it in terms of resources and training. But I would take the opportunity to mention DHS is now doing their own quadrennial homeland review, which is incredibly important. Frankly, I have been an advocate that just as DOD has a five-year budget build, five-year process, DHS needs the same thing. And I would say that to you across not just DHS, but justice and the law enforcement agencies. You know, you talk to CEOs in the private sector. If I talked to the CEO of Verizon, he would say to me, I could not function a multinational company on a one-year budget cycle. I can't make capital investments. I can't do depreciation. I can't do R&D. It's not possible. And yet we expect our civilian agencies to do just that. Well, no wonder they're not very good planners. No wonder they're not very good at R&D for the kinds of technologies we need. We need to get, this is a political problem. This is a Capitol Hill congressional problem. This can be solved. It is not hard in terms of the solution. It's hard in terms of the politics of it. And we need to demand as Americans that Congress solve that problem, because we don't spend efficiently nor effectively against the kind of risks and vulnerabilities that we've been talking about in a one-year cycle. And by the way, we set them up to fail because it's not possible in a one-year cycle.
We have a couple of cyber experts here. I want to throw in a cyber question if I could. We heard the general say that when it comes to cyber, his principal concern is protecting his systems. From your perspective, should NORTHCOM have a different role, a greater role, a bigger role? Specifically, what would it be?
So NORTHCOM, as well as all of DOD and all of the federal government, runs networks that are very much like the private sector. In fact, they're technically the same. It's the same system, same equipment, same protocols, same emails, same websites, same everything. One of the struggles that we've had all along is how does the government, not just the Defense Department, but the government protect itself against the same type of threats that the private sector sees and that the rest of the planet sees, and do that at the same time that they fulfill the expectation of protecting American society. We still don't have a clear role defined yet for how does the Defense Department play in cyberspace. This is a strategic question. When Dave and I were both working on the 03 National Strategy to Secure Cyberspace, that was something that kept coming up, and we tended to kind of lighten it down because we weren't really sure how that fits. The current administration is going to have to come to grips with that. We're going to have a defined role for the Defense Department. It can no longer just be a protect yourself and we'll call you when we need you for something else, but that we have to be clear. So we saw a few weeks ago the release of the 60-day cyber review that came out of the White House. There are recommendations in there. The key one, after they appoint the cyber coordinator, I won't say the czar word, but the cyberspace coordinator, is to develop the strategy, the updated strategy. So that 60-day review is not a strategy. It is a way ahead, and the first recommendation in there is to come up with a strategy. So a key piece of that has to be what is the role of the Defense Department, a very assertive, no kidding, defined role. Once that's laid down, then it's going to make it a whole lot easier for the rest of the federal government, for the private sector, and international to now understand what we do together to protect ourselves in cyberspace. We have been doing a patchwork job all along. I think we've come a long way. That this is a very hard subject, but that type of strategic vision is certainly what we're going to need.
David, your thoughts?
I agree with Mark. The fact that the 60-day review didn't have a clear definition of roles and responsibilities across the agencies, I think, is a demonstration of just how hard it is to get to agreement on those sorts of roles. And so I don't think this will be an easy task to establish the clear running lanes for the different departments and agencies. I do think that there are some important roles that DOD is already playing by transferring some of the capabilities it built up and some of the approaches it's taken over to the civilian agencies, like the trusted internet connections, the reduction of the number of gateways out to the internet that DOD has pursued for a long time and is now being transferred over to DHS and others. I also think that, as the general said, DHS needs to have an important role here. And in the past, people have looked at DHS as, because it's a startup, because it's trying to get its legs underneath it, that maybe it wouldn't have the capacity to be able to deal directly with some of these more difficult tasks like cybersecurity. On the other hand, DHS has spent a lot of time and, in fact, was to some degree created to be an interconnection between the commercial world, the critical infrastructures, and the U.S. government. And it has lots of authorities and lots of capability now in place to be able to make that connection effectively. And so I think it's vital that DHS do have a primary role in the cybersecurity effort, especially as it moves forward and gets beyond securing the classified government domains to trying to create a more secure nation. And so how that DHS role will evolve, I think, is equally important to how DOD and the intelligence community roles evolve.
Some more questions out here? Right there.
Commander Roy, Nellis Embassy, Edward. I'm also struggling with one word, and that's homeland. What's your homeland? You can have different perspectives. Weapons of mass destruction, but also cyber. And what's your homeland? All of you, please.
It depends on who your audience is and what you're talking about, right? Because, of course, the general's got an AOR, right? He's got a command that he's responsible for. I think most importantly, when we use the word homeland, the real audience that we're talking to is not a military audience, and not kind of a very sophisticated policy audience. We're talking to the American people. And so it's how the American people define it, because what you want is their support for its protection, right? And so they think of the cities where they live, they think of where the U.S. borders are and protecting our territory. This is of limited value in the policy world, because we understand in an era of globalization, geographic boundaries don't necessarily define war theaters. You know, a single point of conflict, physical conflict, can result in a global conflagration among enemies, and that's what we've seen in the war on terror. So I take your point. Geographic boundaries don't necessarily help you in terms of defining your ongoing conflict, but I think for purposes of the discussion, when we're using the term generally refers to a conversation, a policy conversation with the American people, and because we can't be successful without their support.
Questions out here? Go ahead, right here. Can we get a mic? Go over here to the front. Oh, right here. Right here.
If we stood back a bit. You got it? Okay. If we stood back a bit and we said, well, it was more than protecting the homeland. It was, when we founded the nation, it was its people and its foreign direct investment, for the Navy to bring out the sea lanes of communication and make sure that they were secure for those investments. If you're dealing in a globalized set of environments and you're protecting that same kind of intellectual capital, do you not have to revisit the issues of authorities to the level that you're not dealing with domestic versus international, but the protection of the intellectual capital that fuels the engine of this economy?
I couldn't agree with you more. I had a front row seat to what I call the train wreck of Dubai Ports world. And I will tell you, it was a xenophobic, it was one of those ugly moments when you're in a public position to say, this is a better country than that. The American people, it really offended me, the reaction. And it preyed on sort of a fear that went back, the reaction to that financial transaction. And it didn't make sense. It was not rational, frankly. I think for a whole bunch of reasons, I mean, it happens to be what I do now, but I think for a whole bunch of reasons, economic and security, it's in our interest to protect the ability for foreign investment to come in. We have to be mindful. We've rebuilt the CFIUS process that allows us to review those transactions and have a better understanding of roles and responsibilities inside the government so it doesn't become, frankly, a scrum, which is what it was before. And so we have to protect underwater seabeds and cables to protect our communications. We have to protect the ability to have financial transactions, mergers and acquisitions, and attract foreign investment in a way that has the foreign investors still comfortable with that there's predictability and transparency in the process. And so I think that this is not just I think it's a security issue with tremendous economic impact as well as being an economic issue.
Let me add a little bit also. Since Fran mentions conversation with the American people, I think that when we say homeland, we also have to have that same conversation with all of our trading partners and virtually every other country around the world. They have their own homelands. We have our homeland. Our homelands are all intersecting now in this globalized, highly connected world where we can still define the physical boundaries. That's easy, you know, where the borders are. But that's meaningless in this century, other than just the nicety of having a place where we can do customs and check our passports. The Europeans, as you know, pretty much torn down that physical interface, even though they have separate countries, long recognizing that border control is crumbling. Here in the United States, we're going to have to come to grips with that as well. And when we talk about homeland, we understand our homeland, but what about the Canadians' homeland? What about the Mexicans' homeland? What about all the Europeans, the Asians, all the other countries? So that conversation has to start extending in a very open manner towards what are the interests of the other homelands, those who have interests here in the United States. How do we help them protect their homeland when part of it sits here in our country?
David. Let me make one quick addition. I think there's a spectrum of areas in what we call homeland security that either have more or less implication and connectivity to the world at large. So, for example, cybersecurity is one where you really do have to think about your definition of homeland and how you're going to deal with it if you call that a homeland issue. Because most of the companies that we deal with, some of which support our defense industrial base, some of which are providing our software, are companies that have just as strong presence in countries that may or may not be our allies as they do in this country. And so how do we ensure that those companies are secure, and how do we work with those companies for things that we feel are highly essential to our homeland security when, in fact, they are global companies? And I think, you know, so we have to broaden our definition of homeland for certain parts of the spectrum just by the very nature of the problem. I think the similarly pandemic is in some sense of a similar vein because, you know, if somebody gets pandemic, if pandemic pops out in some part of the world, we know it's a matter of either 2 weeks to 2 months before it's here. So we can't pretend that we're not going to be directly affected by what's happening in the homelands of other nations. To some degree, some issues that it may be less true that it's so whether it's so dependent on the geography or not. You know, for an IED, that's really going to be a localized event. Natural disasters affect us locally, so I think it's important to think about a spectrum here and deal with those hard issues that really are global in nature.
You mentioned pandemic, and I'd love to follow up on that if I could. What is the military role going to be in a pandemic situation? What are the limitations on what the military role can be in a pandemic?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think one of the hardest issues that we have in the United States for pandemic or for any biological defense is distribution of countermeasures and taking care of the surge in the medical population. It's always been imagined that the military could play a role here in response to that sort of event, potentially by providing medical surge capabilities, potentially, in the worst case, by becoming a distribution mechanism for medicines that are needed out to the population. And so I think the military probably will have an important role from a civil support perspective if a pandemic occurs. Whether that is a well-defined mission at this point or not, I think, is a question. But the military will also have to deal with its own pandemic problem. You know, if we expect 40% absenteeism in the U.S., and that's pretty much a standard that's expected across different countries, if we have a severe pandemic. So obviously, if it's akin to what we've experienced early with swine flu, then it's not nearly so bad. But if we get something akin to the 1918 flu that we had, and we have 40% absenteeism, then what does that do to our military readiness? So beyond being able to potentially provide civil support, the military will have a major issue in just supporting its own missions.
Go ahead, Frank. Gene, you know, it's interesting because it was in the prior administration that there was the strategy was written in the implementation plan. And at the time, there was much sort of grousing about this was hyping a threat that didn't exist. Obviously, to be fair, the new administration was grateful to have had that much thinking on the sorts of issues that David mentions. But first and foremost, fighting in two theaters overseas, the military's role is to protect itself. And there's been tremendous planning and thought put into what that means and how you keep the military healthy so that they are available. But then you have to go through, we're back to where my first comments, and that is military needs to know where it's likely to be called upon and at what numbers, because of course they are forward deployed, and what will the impact be on Guard and Reserve? And that's why I say, you know, the discussion the generals had with governors will be incredibly important, because if one state is hit particularly hard, as we saw in the first wave, for example, Texas, is Texas going to be willing to give up National Guard to help in other states? Not likely, because they may want to call on them, as they've suggested.
Just one more piece to add to that. Also, depending on the stages of such a pandemic, should it become truly global and we start actually millions of lost lives, global stability is in question at that point. And so the role of the military, the historical role, has to be maintained. Goes to your point of soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marine have to be self-protected. The military has to be able to still defend the United States. Most of us don't think that we would see a case of, you know, a tenth or a third or a fourth of the global population dying. But should we get to something like that, then the role of the military is completely clear in the terms of the defense of the country. So we have to have a military. Therefore, self-protection, we start to work backwards, do the backward planning. That has to be the first thing that happens.
There's more questions out there? Right here in the tie. Of course, everyone's wearing a tie. That was a silly way to identify you. The striped tie.
Francois Béchon, Catalyst Partners. When Caverly and others and I were talking about critical infrastructure, I came out of OSD doing critical infrastructure around 9/11 and beyond. And a year or two ago, we were saying that the buzzword for the next administration was going to be resilience. And you picked up on it, David. But 20 years ago, I was with some doctor friends of mine in France with a single payer. And I said, there will be a point where the French government won't have enough money to pay for everything, so that if you're 78 years old and if you have this, 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 and that, they may want to keep you the quality of life as good as possible, but they may not be able to give you everything that they otherwise could. If we talk about resiliency, there's an underlying aspect that comes with it. We have to start making priorities. And so when we look at grants and how, when they started changing which cities could get grants and what size and why and what the criteria were going to be, as long as we were talking about higher fences or more cameras or more police dogs or more this or more that, it's pretty easy to do. But when we start saying resiliency, then we have to say who gets what and how much of it and who's in what order. How do you deal with that, all of you?
I think they're announcing some grants today, as a matter of fact, over DHS.
Yeah, I think the one of the keys is one of the things I mentioned earlier on, which is making sure that we have the right risk-based budgeting process. And Fran kind of alluded to this. This has to work across agencies, People have to, there's not one risk framework in the government right now. DHS has one or perhaps more than one. And then other agencies have their own. And it's not clear which, you know, sort of risk approach we're working off of to begin with. And even when it is clear, there's no mechanism in place to ensure that all the agencies are prioritizing against those risks that are commonly agreed and then making explicit trade-offs in the budget about what needs to get funded and what doesn't based on how we're going to handle the risk in each case. And so until we get to a mature process where we can really think about that systematically at the federal budgeting level, I'm not sure that I'm very sanguine that we're going to be able to do such a sophisticated thing at also the state and local level. It's true that a lot of the money that we sent out to states and localities and to the critical infrastructure in the aftermath of 9/11 went out with not a lot of strings attached. And as a result, I don't know that it was used in the most effective way. So I think it is a priority to make sure that the grants also become more effectively used. And I know there's efforts in place to try to get at better metrics and ways to measure whether they're being used effectively or not. And that work certainly needs to continue. But I think we ultimately need to make sure that we've got the right process in place at the federal level that we can then use to build off at the state and local level.
Dave, I'm glad you mentioned the word metrics because that's what I wanted to get in on. When we say resilient, readiness, things like that, how do we measure it? How do we know that we're there? So when we do the budget allocations, where do you put the next dollar? I think we will always struggle with that in terms of measuring it. There's a lot of politics here in Washington. There's a lot of that around the nation. That's just the fact of the way the world works. But until we are able to quantify and assess risk, come up with ways of determining where is the true gap, then it will continue to be wrapped up in politics, and maybe that's just the best we can do. So risk assessments in terms of metrics is a key that we have to be able to work through. Perhaps this administration can focus more on that and pick up where the previous one left off.
One of the things in the grant-making process to state and locals was a huge headache to me, because after you buy enough cameras, you ought to stop doing it, right? Well, that was not going to happen. And then, lower your bar. The next bar you try to get over is, okay, do we need the same amount of investment in Connecticut that we need in New York City? Common sense would probably tell you no, except the co-chairman of the committee is from Connecticut. So that didn't go over very well either. So my next bar down was to say, you know what, not only should there be metrics, we should say publicly what they are when we give money to the states, and then we ought to scorecard them. My pals in the military will love this. We're going to do a stoplight chart on every state for every dollar. We gave it to you for X. You did Y with it. That's bad, right? And just hold the governors accountable. That wasn't politically popular, but here's the interesting thing. When we told the governors that was my recommendation, it was like sort of being against applehood, apple pie and motherhood. They couldn't sort of say, geez, I don't want to be held accountable. But nobody's doing it. And part of that is agreeing on what the measure is that you're going to hold them accountable for. You can't very well hold them accountable until you tell them what that is. And so I think that is the first hurdle, and somebody's got to really take that on. My second problem in terms of this issue is there isn't anybody other than the director of OMB and the other two people you call sir in the White House, who's got the ability to look at the cross-cut budget, to set priorities across the government, rationalize, make sure you're not spending dollars in different departments on the same capability or against the same problem. Somebody needs to be able to look. I didn't have that authority as the President's Homeland Security Advisor. I think somebody in the White House who's responsible at a senior level for Homeland Security policy needs to have cross-cutting budget authority to be able to make sure that we come back to, what's important is where you spend money. And if somebody who sets policy priorities doesn't then have the ability to look across the federal budget and say, wait a minute, we're not spending consistent with the President's objectives. Besides, the director of OMB's got that, but he's not the guy also involved. He's not got the primary or in the policy side. And so I think we need to rationalize. If you want me to be in charge of setting the policy, then I need to have some ability to make sure we're spending money consistently.
I wanted to bring this back to Katrina, if I could, which is where we really saw the military in action. And Fran, in your report, you lined up some of the problems. I mean, there was problems with the military collaborating with other agencies. There was pushback from state and local government. The military active and guard units had problems with command and control. How far have we come? I mean, did the states and locals still see the military response as that 800-pound gorilla that they don't want interfering on their turf? Are there still big gaps, big issues of cooperation and collaboration that still have not been addressed that need to be?
I actually think in the general addresses, I think by and large, people took a very serious hard look at the recommendations and worked away at implementing them. Here's the one that I think is important, and it's hard to solve not in a crisis. It's even harder, by the way, to solve in a crisis. There is better coordination between DHS and NORTHCOM on the one hand, and the governors, because it's important. This is not just a guard issue. You can't get to the guard without going through the governors. And so there's better coordination between NORTHCOM and the guard, between NORTHCOM and DHS and the governors. The issue is not, I don't think that the governors resent the military. They actually want access to military capabilities in a crisis. They just don't want to give up control of their National Guard assets to DOD. I'm not satisfied because that is a hotly political issue. I mean, that is the third rail of gubernatorial politics in a crisis, that's been solved. This is one of these, we argued it and wrestled it to what I might equate to a detente, and it's left now to NORTHCOM as the proxy for the federal government to try and work with the adjutant generals in each state, but that's a one-state-at-a-time solution, and it's about the best you can do at the moment, but I don't think we should kid ourselves that we've solved that problem. We have.
Great. Any other pressing questions out there? Otherwise, here you go.
Here I am. I just want to say thanks so much to everybody for a wonderful panel discussion. Thanks, Jean, for hosting, and
thank you,
all of you, for your very insightful comments. I also want to thank our sponsor, Rolls-Royce, for sponsoring a great series of events on the QDR. Thank you, Darren Helston, your colleagues at Rolls-Royce. We hope to see everybody again soon. Thanks for coming. And we appreciate everybody's time. Have a good afternoon.
Take care. Thank you.